shouldn't really be a huge amount of difference between us and the listeners. So I think maybe in our best moments, hopefully they see us as a kind of mouthpiece for talking about the stuff they're talking about. I don't remember when I was a kid anyone talking about football the way I used to talk about it with my mates, and hopefully I still do that now.
Hello and welcome to Outlines, a podcast about sport, stories and the media. My name's Owen Connolly. Hope you're well. Great to have you with us, whether you're joining for the first time or you're back for more. Now, the Football Ramble is the UK's biggest independent football podcast. It's also quite probably the oldest, having launched all the way back in 2007. Its premise is simple and it's stayed fairly consistent. A regular rotation of guests gather around a table to talk about recent developments in the game. And as the name suggests, the conversation can be a little looser, a little baggier, a little more jocular than sports media can sometimes get. But its lasting success also makes it a fascinating model for understanding how podcasting has developed as a medium and as a business in the last couple of decades. Well, the other week I went to the now former Football Ramble studio in North London. More on that later in the episode, to talk to Luke Moore, one of the original members of the gang and the co-founder and COO of Stack, a production company that grew out of the Ramble in 2018. We talked about the long evolution of the Ramble, what's worked and what hasn't worked so well in progressing the show, and its relationship with its audience and how that's reflected in the content and the commercial model. And we also discussed Stack, the origins and aims of the company, what makes for a great podcast, whether Stack produces it or not, and the kind of programs that Luke and his team set out to create. Football Ramble is a very well-established podcast. This is a pretty new one. So if you're enjoying it so far, please do subscribe, leave a rating and a nice review on your preferred platform, share links, spread the word, check out the socials details in the show notes there, and help us get more people involved. We've got more stories and ideas to dive into in the weeks ahead, but this is well worth your time now. Here is Luke Moore. All right, we're rolling. I can see.
Yeah, we're good.
Cool. So it's funny, they say this business is about who you know, and in our case, my two-year-old son knows your two-year-old son from the playground, so that's the
correct.
That's the connection here. We could have gone the kind of parenting podcast route, but instead we're doing this.
Yeah, I don't think I'd have been much used to that, to be honest.
I would either.
It's all a bit of a learning curve for me, mate. I'm not one of those experts yet.
But where you do specialise is in podcasts, and particularly football podcasts. How long has the Ramble been going now?
Ramble started in 2007. I guess the proper starting point for it, for in terms of we actually had a plan for it, or you know, something resembling a plan, and tried to kind of make a fist of it, is probably 2008. But the first episodes we recorded were in April of 2007.
Yeah, so you're really like you're in the kind of etymology era of podcasting. You know, when it was iPods.
Yeah, basically, yeah, I guess so. Yeah, I've never heard it called the etymology era before, but that does make sense. Yeah, there wasn't much around then. I mean, to be honest, I know that. No one really knew what podcasts were then because I didn't know.
Yeah.
And I was doing one. So it makes total sense to me that other people hadn't caught on to it at that point. So yeah, it was very, very early.
Yeah. What was the spark for it? Where did it come from?
The spark came from it because I did some university radio stuff, did a Saturday sports show with some friends, and then left that particular college in 2002. And I was working in London for a commercial radio station then from about 2004 onwards. And one of my friends from then, Marcus, who is he's the host of the Ramble now, just reached out to me with a couple of other guys, one of whom I didn't know, saying that we're going to do this football podcast. Do you want to do it? And I said, oh, yeah, that sounds fine. I quite like talking about football. I'm doing it anyway. And he was like, look, it was fun when we did the Saturday sports show together at uni, so let's just do it. And I said, yeah, I'm up for that. I was kind of always up for doing extracurricular stuff. Yeah. I was kind of felt like I had a kind of drive to do more, but I didn't really have a channel for it. And I was working a bit in music at the time, working at commercial radio, as I said. And but I was like, yeah, I'm up for it. And I hadn't seen Marcus properly, I don't think, for a while at that point. And I said, look, can you do me a favor though? Can you come to my house and do it? Because then I'll do it. Otherwise, I just probably won't get around to doing it, kind of thing, or travel. And they said, yeah. So they came to mine, and we started making the first episodes originally fortnightly, and we didn't really know at all what we were doing. We just kind of sat around, chatted for what seemed like a few hours into a mini disc player then. And then one of the guys, Chris, who's no longer a part of it, he would just go and edit it together and stick it up. And that was that, really.
Yeah. So what was, what were you working from at that point? I'm trying to think what was around even at any point in the 2000s, really. You had The Guardian.
Gervais was doing one.
Gervais, yeah. But that was a radio show. Was that not a radio show that they kind of...
made into a podcast, yeah. Gervais was doing one. Guardian were doing just about doing Football Weekly, and they started around the same time. There was no real reference point.
Yeah.
It was kind of... My thing was that I think looking back on it, I quite wanted to be on the radio. When I was a kid, I used to listen to the radio all the time. Even when people would tell me about they would always watch TV in their rooms... and about their parents knowing and stuff. I kind of did do a bit of that, but I was mostly just listening to the radio. I used to tune it into BBC Radio Solent, the clock radio under my bed, and just listen to it. And I was kind of always fascinated by it. And I think I probably always wanted to be on radio. But when I went to the university, and the first time, because I went a couple of times, but the first time when I went, the people who were there in that vocational area of radio, learning about radio, which I did a bit of, they all had like radio voices, had done internships at local radio stations. I had never done any of that. And I just felt like, God, I haven't really got a broadcast voice, which a lot of those types had and still do have. And I was like, well, it's not really going to be for me. I never really thought it was available to me. So when I say I worked in commercial radio, I just worked on the sales floor with a couple of people. It turned out to be really influential people for different reasons later on. And I thought this was probably a good outlet for me.
Yeah.
Because I'm always talking. I've always got an opinion on everything, you know, and that's probably why I did it. I didn't think to myself, if I do this, they'll give me a radio show. I just thought, oh, I'll do this instead of it. And that's kind of how it transpired, really, in a way.
Yeah. And just, I don't want to dwell too long or linger too long on this part of the conversation, but like, it is really interesting that would have been the closest analog at that point to something like a podcast, would have been talk radio or sports radio or whatever.
Yeah.
But podcasts have broken containment in terms of what you can do with the formats and all that sort of stuff. I mean,
yeah.
How sensitive were you to that early on, and how much were you just kind of doing a Five Live type of thing?
It's a really good question, and I think there's always a tendency when I get asked about this stuff a reasonable amount by either listeners or people in the industry or whatever. And what I've found over the years is there's a real tendency to backfill the narrative. Mm-hmm. About things that just simply probably weren't the case. So I'm going to try and avoid doing that today, but there must have been some kind of, even just through osmosis or subconsciously, some kind of idea that because I used to listen to 606 all the time.
Yeah.
And I used to listen to talk radio quite a lot. And I used to do things like phone in to radio stations like Power FM and stuff and ask for songs to be played because I didn't own the song or whatever. And of course there was no streaming then. So I was very kind of, I guess, conversant with radio as a thing without even really knowing about it. So I think that there was probably a bit of that going on, but at the same time, I can't overplay that because I don't think we had any reference point whatsoever. I think Marcus probably quite fancied himself as a presenter, and rightly so, because he's a good one. The other guys, myself included, had things to say, and we thought we were funny. And I do have a memory of thinking, the only time I ever hear people talk about football the way that I talk about it is when I hear a phone-in show.
Sure.
And so maybe there's a bit of that going on as well. But we'll probably come on to this. But I think the most overriding factor was that, of course, it started to get listeners. And then once it starts to get listeners, and you don't really know how, which is what happened with us, it's almost like a wave that you either decide to ride or not. And then you can start to mold it because you start thinking, well, I've got something here. What do I do with it? Rather than just this ephemeral... kind of almost just quite nebulous cloud of stuff.
Yeah.
You're just turning up every couple of weeks because you like doing things and that's it. That's when it started to mold, sort of form into something when you started to realize there was actually people listening.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, we're going to hope that people are listening to this. And also,
that would be great.
Yeah, but also jump forward, where are we, about 17 years or so to today? And it's a very different landscape and people very much know what podcasts are now.
Yeah, of course.
But what kind of place would you say that Football Ramble occupies in the podcast media landscape? Because it's... Yeah, today. Because it's so different. And you guys now are, you know, you've gone from being, you know, a homebrew or at least a sort of pure startup exercise to a point of reference for other people.
Yeah. I think, yeah, you have very little control over that in the position I'm in, though. But I accept that that has happened. It occupies, I think it's probably a legacy product now, like a legacy show. I think, you know, you've got people now who are making decisions in the industry or who are commissioning shows or producing shows or even presenting shows maybe that would have had some kind of contact with the Ramble for good or bad. You know, they would certainly, I think, certainly be aware of it. So I think it's a legacy show from that point of view because we have people, I meet people now, we did a live tour earlier this year and you meet people now, father and son, father and son's like coming together. I used to listen to my Dave Spitzel on the car when I was like 8 years old and now I've just finished uni or whatever, you know. So it's definitely a legacy product. In terms of what it occupies as an actual show,
yeah,
I think, and this, you know, you're probably going to get one or two biased answers from me today because you know, I'm in it, so it's hard to be unbiased. I think it occupies a unique place. I think it's not, it's hard to pigeonhole it, which I think is a blessing and a curse, but it's not a YouTube show in style, even though it does appear on YouTube in its entirety. Clearly, we're not ex-pro footballers. One or two of us are good journalists, qualified journalists, who have been successful in their own right for big outlets. But generally speaking, I wouldn't say it's a journalism show. I think the people we have on who are qualified journalists, that's not the reason they're on. That's probably in spite of it rather than because of it. And so I think it occupies that sweet spot between YouTube, which is, excuse, young and is a bit more shouty, and ex-pro journalist types, which can be a bit out of touch, a bit cringe. And in the journalist side of it, it can be a bit earnest. And I think I like to think there's an authenticity about the Ramble because what you hear is genuinely what it is. It's not really over. It's never really scripted. And we kind of shoot from the hip on big issues. 99% of the funny moments that a listener to our show will treasure, possibly even 100% of it is impromptu and unscripted and unplanned. And I think that brings a kind of immediacy to it and a kind of excitement to it. And I think it's hard to talk about that in too much detail without sounding like an egomaniac. But I am only a small part of the broadcast team. I mean, there's six of us, so it's only I'm only a small part of it. But I think it occupies a unique position because I say legacy on one side and I say the actual place it occupies on the other. But I think those two things are related because I think it's very difficult now. It would be almost impossible now to come in and make a show like that because you haven't got that water under the bridge, that legacy aspect to it where you know each other so well that it's so authentic for good and bad. So you can have a good old row on here and it's never taken personally. You can have a good old laugh with people you're comfortable with. I listen to the sort of YouTube end of that stuff and to me it feels a bit inauthentic, a bit manufactured, a bit
kayfabe.
Yeah, I think so. A bit clickbaity as well. So I think it's a unique position it occupies. I don't have a full understanding of what that is, but that's how I try to explain it to people.
Yeah.
If that makes sense to you as a...
Yeah, and I mean, you know, we'll come on a bit later to whether something like this could come out now or what it might be if it came out now. I think we'll come back to that. But what's interesting for you guys is, you know, it's something you set up in a personal, experimental way. It's now obviously a very established brand and business and all the rest of it. And you've had to guide the show through that period. Like, what's your approach been to that journey, for want of a better word? Because there are going to be times when you're self-conscious about it and there are going to be times when you're just kind of letting things happen, I suppose, in that development.
I mean, I guess a bit kind of hit and miss, a bit kind of steer it the best you can, I suppose. It's a complicated question to answer because we have Stack, which is the production company that is the umbrella company, which I co-own and help to run. And there's some people involved in that that aren't, you know, known in the industry because they choose not to be known because they do things in the background and very successful they are at them too. So it's important when you want to answer these questions to understand the context that I'm rarely, if ever, making these decisions on my own.
Yeah, sure.
I'm perhaps the public face of some of it and have to step up and speak for on behalf of it and all that kind of stuff. But it's never, ever really me just doing it on my own. So I can't take full credit or full blame for anything that's happened. But I think that my approach to it has been, you know, focus on what you're passionate about and lead into that and go with your gut. But at the same time, we're fortunate here now because we've got people who work in data and people who work at other platforms, and we can pick up the phone to PR people, whatever, and kind of get a wisdom of crowds type thing going on. But there's certainly been things in the past that have happened that have been decisions that I've driven that have been the wrong decisions, for sure. But ultimately, you know, you're not ever really going to make 100% of correct decisions anyway doing this type of thing. And what's important, I've learned, is that you take responsibility for it and you just, you know, stick your neck out and you say, this is what I think we should do. And if you have to adjust, you adjust. So to me, I try always, I mean, people may not think this, I may not always succeed in this, but I always try and think of what the listener wants and what they expect from, if we're just talking about the ramble, what they expect from the ramble and what they like about it and what makes them happy to listen to it and what gives them that reason to make an appointment to subscribe and to,
yeah,
or even to become a Patreon subscriber or whatever. That's really at the heart of everything. We don't have a meeting here before a show and ever talk about anything other than what the listeners expect of us. And that's not to say you hand over all editorial decisions to the listeners, because obviously that's not even a, you know, it's not an individual listener in mind. It's just that, for example, there could be a really good story out there, but it's not a ramble story.
Yeah.
So we'll let On the Continent, our European show, do it, or you know, or we'll just not touch it because, yeah, it's not that relevant to our listenership. And I think that's an important part of it as well. And I think every presenter here and every producer here, it needs to have a really good understanding of what the listenership is.
Yeah.
And I think they do.
Yeah. What are some examples, if you're happy to share them, of things that have gone a little bit wrong, where you've particularly if you've done something intentional and it's not quite panned out the way you expected it to or whatever? Because I feel like if you've got something that's a little ineffable that you're describing there about, you know, the relationship with the listener and,
yeah,
and the chemistry that you have as a team and the things that are in your wheelhouse and the things that aren't, it feels almost like sometimes you're going to learn more from the stuff that doesn't quite come off than you are from something that's just kind of, you know.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, you absolutely learn a lot from that kind of thing. Like, I mean, I don't think I ever learned anything from winning an award for having the best show or whatever, which sometimes happens. I don't think it's great. I'm very grateful, but I don't think you get an awful lot of learning out of that. I think the big thing that probably, I was using as an example, and what I think people who know the show well would probably expect me to use as an example, is probably what happened around COVID, where in the lead up to COVID, I felt like the show was getting a bit dull and a bit samey, and I felt like we needed to change it up. I think, you know, it was four of us at the time. We'd been together for 12 years. It was the same four people in the same room every other day or whatever it was. And for me, it was getting a little bit boring. And I think that the way I would have, if I had my time again, the way I would have addressed that would have been different. And what we ended up doing is getting a load of new people in and not thinking about it properly enough and not understanding what the listeners expected. And probably at that point, for me, I can't speak on behalf of the other guys, but I it was basically my responsibility, so I should take the responsibility for it. I felt like I didn't, probably looking back on it, I didn't fully understand what the ramble actually was. And it was about around the time when, you know, COVID started to happen, things were socially were getting very people were getting a lot more aware about representation, diversity, that kind of stuff. And that's not to say that's why we did it, but it was definitely informing of the decision. And we brought a load of new people in, all of whom are great in their own right. And this is not meant as a criticism of them at all. And indeed, two of them are still involved. It didn't kind of work, and the listeners didn't accept it. And I think the way that I personally dealt with that, and I know I'm talking about myself because I can't really speak on behalf of anyone else who's not here, and you're asking me, so I guess I've got to speak on behalf of myself in this case. I dealt with it quite badly. I think what I should have done is listened more and tried to adjust. And I think what I ended up doing is probably more along the lines of, well, it's our show, not yours. We do what we want. And if you don't like it, tough shit kind of thing. And I think that was probably a mistake. And I think it took us a while to get past that. We brought the show back to a different place now, which we're really happy with. But it taught me a lesson to understand exactly what our show is and what the relationship is with the listeners. And I think that's pretty hard-won experience. It was never like it was, you know, terminally bad or anything like that. It was never going to stop or fall over, but it was just a difficult time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Does that answer the question?
It does. Yeah. And I think it's, you know, I think it, it does speak to that thing of, you know, and it's not just about the success. It's about the things that you successfully incorporate. You don't notice sometimes so much as when you push something too far or try something that doesn't quite fit.
I think the story of the Ramble has been more than anything else about the relationship between the hosts and the relationship between the listeners and the host.
Yeah.
They're the two main core points of it. And I think if we turn our back on either of those things, it's not good.
Yeah. Yeah. How has the podcast marketplace changed in that time as well? And COVID's an interesting inflection point, you know, to introduce, because that's when I think everybody realized how low the barrier to entry can be for podcasting. You saw a lot of new things appear.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, still something that,
but I think
very
I think
much the case,
I think the barrier to entry thing is talked about a lot on podcasting. I think it's a little bit overplayed.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you why, because when you think about a barrier to entry in any kind of entertainment industry product, for want of a better term, they're kind of the same across the board. And what I mean by that is, you know, we're probably roughly the same age. Back when we were young or younger, we could make a film if we wanted.
Yeah.
There's nothing stops making a film. Would it be a good film? Maybe, maybe not. Would it have a budget? No. Would it be picked up? Probably not, but it could.
Like,
there's loads of examples of really low budget movies doing well, you know, across history. Same with, you know, writing a book, you know, could you write a book and get a publisher? Maybe not, but you could write a great book if you were good at it. And it might get picked up.
Yeah.
It's kind of the same with podcasting. The barrier to entry is low. People did realize it through COVID. I think that's correct to say that. The barrier to entry to making a good podcast, regardless of the format you're going for, whether it's a narrative thing or a studio thing or whatever, that's still quite high.
Yeah.
And the reason it's quite high is because it needs expertise, experience, resources, blah, blah, blah. It's the same with every media, really. I don't think there's too much difference.
Yeah.
So people discovered the fact that they could just sit in their bedroom and chat shit because of the internet. Did that produce a load of really good shows? Some. Would they have been produced anyway? Maybe, you know. I think it probably changed the attitude of people because they had nothing to do, but I don't think it really changed the barrier to entry of podcasting, which has always, in my view, always been the same.
Yeah. I suppose the other thing that, to come back to what we were talking about with audiences, is you set your audience expectations with how you produce something. So if something is highly produced...
Yeah.
I'm not quite sure where I'm going with this point, but basically if you have something that's for a niche or, a less expectant audience,
mm-hmm.
you can get away with more if you kind of understand what the... I hear quite high-end podcasts, for example, or quite well-listened-to podcasts that don't necessarily have the level of polish in the sound quality or whatever. But people know, oh, this person's calling in from here or this person's...
But that's a tricky situation as well, Owen, because... We're not in, as producers, we're not in control of all that anyway.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that is this studio we're in now is nice, right? It's a good studio, high end. It's, you know, the audio is probably as good as any you'll hear anywhere. Right. But I can't control what headphones someone's going to listen to on the way home, whether they're on the tube with their Apple 10p headphones, which literally cost 10p to make in, you know, China or whatever, or whether they're going to be sitting at home in a nice big studio and laboring over every single, you know, or pop. And so we're only in control of a percentage of that anyway. What experience tells me is that listeners will accept anything above a certain threshold.
Sure.
So if you listened to, I mean, The Rest Is Politics, good example, probably the most listened to podcast in the country. Sometimes the audio quality is good. Sometimes one of them's in like an airport departure lounge. Do the listenership care? Doesn't look like it. Doesn't seem like they do to me.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm not, you know, I'm not bagging on them. I think it's a great show. I listen to it all the time and I like the producers as well. So I think you have to get to a certain level, but I don't think it has to be amazing. But having said that, if you are starting a new project, particularly these days, I don't think I would recommend not doing it well, chiefly just because it's so easy to get hold of affordable stuff now.
Mm.
And I don't think there's much excuse for it. And I think the excuse that The Rest Is Politics, for example, will make is the fact that, you know, you want an authentic voice in someone like Roy Stewart. Well, guess what? He travels all the time. He's busy. He's got these connections. He's got all this work on. You accept that as the price of being a listener because you're like, well, I'd rather hear his take on this from the departure lounge at Heathrow Terminal 5 than not hear it at all because he's busy. So I think there's a trade-off that maybe listeners don't even realise themselves, but I think that's what's going on.
Yeah. I suppose the other thing that's probably changed, particularly in the last 10 years, is the way that audiences are monetized in this space, or at least the way that...
There's a market for it now, and there wasn't about 10 years ago is when it started.
Yeah. What's changed in that department? I mean, you know, the cliche with podcast advertising was always, it sounded like the same five, like, you know, the mattress company and the vitamins and the rest of it.
I don't think it's that now.
It certainly isn't that now. And it's really interesting to see the way that different media companies and different, whether they've, you know, whether they're independent or whether they've started up themselves or whether it's sort of these, whether it's a big media company that's moving into podcasting, but they've all got different models. You know, you guys, it's a community business, so it makes sense to have, you work, you have a membership model, but you also have live tours and
We do lots of different bits and pieces, yeah. I think it's generally a good idea as an independent business to diversify how you make money as much as possible. Because otherwise you're too reliant on something, then if that particular area goes downhill, you're very exposed. But, I mean... Without trying to dodge the question, I'm not the person responsible for the commercialization of our shows here at this company. So I wouldn't be the expert to speak to, but I obviously have, you know, contact with it and have to help on that side of things too. And it's now an industry where it wasn't before. If you're going to frame it as 10 years hence, then I think, you know, 10 years, 2014 is when Acast first come and start trading in the UK. And I know that because the Ramble was the first show to go with them.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of went from there. But the context then was we weren't really making any money then.
Yeah.
And now you start to... So it took 3-4 years from 2014 to 2018 for it to mature enough for us to be able to start Stack at the start of 2018.
Yeah.
And even then it was a very small operation, but we were just about making enough to pay ourselves. And in the summer of 2017, I left a full-time job for the first time. So 10 years after starting it, I was able to do full-time podcasting. And then the industry started to grow from there. But it's still got a long way to go. I mean, we don't make, in terms of membership, Patreon, stuff like that, tours, we don't make anywhere near enough money to sustain a business. The lion's share of the revenue will be stuff like sponsorship and advertising and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So, I mean, how, you know, how much, again, is there a relationship between what you're able to do or willing to do on that side and the community and, the expectations of your audience? There'll be certain things that will feel like you're adding value, and there'll be certain things that will feel like, you know, you're maybe stepping onto the wrong path.
Well, we've chosen to make this a business, and we've chosen to be entrepreneurs and try and be successful in it. And that means, what does that mean? It means, you know, critical success, you know, commercial success, you know, making it not just a going concern, but a profitable one. And that's a decision we kind of consciously took.
Yeah.
And so we have to rely upon doing that in a respectful way to our listenership and bringing enough of them along with us. And of course, there's loads of stuff we wouldn't do commercially because it would alienate our audience, and it would be, and that sounds like it's a noble thing, but actually there is nobility to it, but there's also an element to the fact that, you know, the golden rule is you don't piss off your audience, right? Mm. If you piss off your audience for a quick buck, you ain't going to be around for very long anyway. So it's a practical decision as well. I think, you know, the lion's share of our audience understand that there's going to be adverts in the show. Mm-hmm. And I think we try and do as much as we can to meet them halfway, which is we offer them an ad-free option. You know, don't get that with Sky TV. You pay them $150 a month, you still get adverts, you know. You want to, you know, watch something on Sky Go, you're bombarded with adverts, you know. TalkSport, adverts. Everywhere you go, there's adverts. There's commercialization of a product. And I think we're still going through the growing pains in podcasting of the idea that this is not a bedroom hobbyist thing anymore. This is an industry.
Yeah.
And part of my job is to fight really hard to get it taken seriously. And to get it taken seriously, you need to show that it's a viable, you know, loads of different things. It needs to be a viable career for the team who work here. You know, they love podcasts, but they need to know they can earn money if they want to get a job in it. It can't just be hobbyist. I can't just say to people, you know, I can chuck you a shift once every couple of weeks for £50. You know, we operate as a proper business. You know, they get full-time contracts, they get looked after, they get sick pay, pensions, holiday, place to come and work, a community, you know, all this kind of stuff. And to do that, you need money. And so I think we've built that audience ourselves. We're grateful for the listenership for coming with us. But the listenership we have for the Ramble has been a hard won over many, many years. And we have the right to do what we want with that. And of course we do it respectfully. And of course we try and make the best shows we can for our listeners, because that's what we love to do. But as part of that, you know, we still make, we earn money as well. I've got a family. You know, I need to feed, they need to be fed. And
sure,
the people who complained on the margins about this would probably be the first people to complain when an episode was missed, because I had to have a full-time job, right? So you can't spend too much time worrying about that. You just got to do what you think is the right thing to do.
No, absolutely. And on the other side of that, is there anything more that you've learned about your listeners, about your community, from being able to do things like... Is it Patreon you work with?
Yeah.
Being able to do things like Patreon or like the live shows or...
Well, because I think you get a FaceTime with people and meeting people and chatting to them is good. Otherwise, you're in danger in this game of just, you know, treating listeners like a number on a screen, and that's not healthy for anyone. I would say, from my point of view, the people who love the show enough to pay for it are the people that I want to listen to. They clearly have a vested interest in it. They have a stake in it. They have opinions, and I do my best. We have a Discord community on the Patreon that I'm in quite a lot, at least every day. You know, just not always posting, but reading what people are saying. You know,
yeah.
And sometimes we adjust, and sometimes maybe they're saying something because they haven't got quite the full picture, so you have to kind of explain to them this is why this is happening. But a lot of time they're making entirely valid points, and it means we can adjust course. You know, we do an extra episode that's only just for people who pay, and I like to listen to what they think of it, because if they think it's a bit shit, then we'll change it, because it's for them. You know, it's extra content for them that they've paid for, so I'm happy to listen to them.
Yeah.
And going back to what I said earlier, though, you can't... I'm the professional here. Right? I'm doing this for a job, right? It's been 17 years. That's a big enough clue that anyone that I can do this, and I'm good at it. So I'm not going to let them dictate to me what happens,
no.
But I'm going to use their insight as a listener to adjust what I do to keep them happy. Because ultimately, you know, it's like anything. I always go back to it with the team, you know. Ultimately, just think of yourself as a car salesman. Everything can be viewed through the lens of being a car salesman, right? If everyone says your cars are shit, you need to change your cars, right? If one person says they're shit, it's probably, you know, take it on board, but move on, right?
Yeah.
And there's so much you can do with that analogy. Like, you know, I always think of the synopses and the artwork as the shop window, right? Put your best cars in the shop window, you know? Keep the glass clean, you know? Tell people why the show's great. You know, you don't, car salesmen, they don't just, when you walk into a showroom, they don't just go, oh, there's the cars, yeah, I'll speak to you in a minute. They say, what are you looking for today? You know, this is why this car's great. What's your personal situation? You've got to try and sell stuff into people because there's got so much choice. Not because you're conning them, but because there's 4,000 podcasts they can listen to.
Yeah.
So why should they listen to yours?
Yeah. No, absolutely. Do you feel like it's a strange question to ask you, or it's maybe not that helpful a question to ask you, because you guys have always, I feel like, had that community element, and that's kind of how you've grown, because you didn't launch off the back of a newspaper or the BBC or whatever.
No. They're all cheating.
But like the closer podcasts become about community, do they move back towards what those radio phone-in shows you used to listen to became about, or does that relationship kind of crop up in a different way?
I don't know if that's a helpful comparison. I think the community aspect is, what does it mean? It means there's a load of different people who maybe have similar sensibilities who like the same individual thing.
Yeah.
And through our community Discord, there is a genuine community. You know, there's people meeting up and, you know, going for beers before live shows or going to watch the football together or whatever. But then it's hard to answer that question, because I don't really know if I can take any credit for that, or the team can take any credit for that, because I think they just like the show, right? And that's good. I don't really know what people mean when in our industry when they say, talk about community, because I think a lot of them just think it means occasionally they'll do a meetup or occasionally they'll send out a t-shirt or whatever. And I think what it probably means to us is that we're closer to them than we are, you know, like fucking Emily Maitlis and John Sopel or whatever, who are basically, this is not a criticism of their show at all, but the position they're in is they are traditional legacy broadcasters who are almost town criers telling everyone what's happening.
Yeah.
Which I feel like we're kind of try to be more in the mix, like right amongst it. And I don't think there's any kind of real, shouldn't really be a huge amount of difference between us and the listeners. So I think maybe in our best moments, hopefully they see us as a kind of mouthpiece for talking about the stuff they're talking about. Because like I said earlier, I don't remember when I was a kid anyone talking about football the way I used to talk about it with my mates. And hopefully I still do that now.
Yeah.
And that would suggest, if that is the case, I don't want to be kind of too, take it for granted, but that would be that would suggest that we're much more similar to them. Mm-hmm. And we're almost a part of the community rather than just preaching about a community.
Sure. And I suppose that probably is a better way of reframing it, where it's not about a format or a construct. It's like a sensibility or a wavelength you guys are talking about. Because the thing we've barely talked about in this, where are we, half an hour or so far, is football.
Mm.
And you're all football fans and you're talking about football, and sometimes you're talking about the game. A lot of the time you're talking about things around it, whether that's, things in the industry, or whether that's just the flotsam and jetsam that kind of drift up from watching games.
Mm. What we're aiming for is I want people to see something that happens on a Sunday afternoon game and go, I can't wait to hear what the lads say about that on Monday, right? And we very much understand that. For better or worse, and not trying to use this whole interview to make out that we're perfect and we know what we're doing and that no one else does, but we are definitely close to our listenership, even if just in sensibility, and a lot of shows are. I can't tell you the amount of times I'll listen to something or see something, or a clip will be shared in my timeline, or someone will tell me about something, and I'm sitting there in my position in this industry going, who's that for?
Mm-hmm.
What is that show? Like, who are they doing this for? And I'll give you an example. News agents, just because it springs to mind because I just mentioned them earlier, they're all standing around when the US election happens in their sunglasses and their leather jackets, talking about how great the sandwich they've just had at some deli in Washington, D.C. is. Who's that for? Well, I'll tell you who it's for. It's for fucking them. It's for them to show off about how great they are, right? Now, that's not for me. If that's what people like, that's fine. I'm not trying to tell people not to listen to it, or I don't know any of them personally, so I'm sure they're great. But that's not really what we're trying to do here. Mm. What we're trying to do here is have a chat in a way that people are invited into it. Now, they can't talk because they're not on the show, but they can listen. And I don't think I wouldn't like us to go down that road where we're just preaching. And you know, I hate it when you hear football journalists on Twitter complaining about the Wi-Fi in the press box. It's fucking embarrassing. You've got an amazing job. Serve your audience. Don't serve yourself. And I'm not saying we always get it right. And I actually get a lot more stick than all the other hosts, so I'm probably doing shit at it. But I am trying to do it.
Yeah, sure. Other developments here, I mean, let's talk a bit more kind of creatively. You have other strands of the podcast. Obviously, you've got the main Football Ramble show, which is still the flagship, and it's still where most of your audience will be. But you do have these other shows that you put out. How do you develop those? How do you decide what's
right? Do you mean
right?
Other Stack shows?
We'll get onto Stack next, but I mean Ramble, within the Football Ramble kind of family.
We try and treat every Ramble episode as important as every other one. Mm-hmm. So Monday and Friday are naturally the biggest episodes because they're either looking ahead to the weekend's games or they're reflecting on what's happened, and that's where the action is. The shows during the week are as important to us as the other ones.
Yeah.
They're not listened to much differently to the other main ones anyway. And what is it about now? Well, what it's about now is about understand that football's basically permanent, happens every day. If there's not a game, there's going to be some stories, and we just try and reflect that.
Yeah.
So the reason that we're doing shows a lot more often on the Football Ramble feed is because you don't have this ebb and flow that you used to have of, a game, you build up to a game, you cover a game, you react to a game, you rest, you build up to the next game. It's now just constant. And I think that we have to find that sweet spot of making sure we've always got a show for people to listen to that reflects how modern football is, but it isn't so often that people can't keep up.
Yeah.
And so our approach to Football Ramble episodes is just, we want to make them every day. We want to do every weekday. We want to do them. We don't do them Saturdays and Sundays. And we won't be doing Saturdays and Sundays from now on because the audience isn't there. I guess it's because people aren't commuting. I'm not really sure, but it makes more sense for us to do Monday through Friday. So we do that. We're just simply trying to reflect and keep up with the news that's happening.
Yeah.
And we do it with our own slant on it, with hopefully an entertaining kind of slant on it. But that's why we're doing what we're doing.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, but in terms of the content of that, you have your...
Yeah.
Across the Continent show and
On the Continent and up front. Well, yeah, On the Continent is basically because Andy Brassel is the best European football journalist in the world, and he's we're fortunate to have him, and he deserves his own show, so he's got one.
Mm-hmm.
And we can't do, it's just impossible to cover Europe. I can't do the ramble, run a company, have a family and do European football as well. It's just impossible, and I would never be at the standard I'd be happy with to do it. So Andy does it with Dot, and they do it well, and they have different people come in that we like that fit into the aesthetic of how we do things, and that's important to us because I don't have any interest in working with football journalists who take themselves too seriously and who don't wear their knowledge lightly. And it goes back to what I was saying earlier about the news agents. I don't want people to be in a studio competing for who's got the most knowledge. I want people to be able to, you know, dilute down into things that people are interested in, the knowledge that is relevant to that particular story. And that's what hopefully separates On the Continent out from some other shows. Up front is a women's football show. It's important for us to have a women's football show to lead from the front on that and to support women's football. And we've got two great people that do that as well. And we've also got Second Tier, which is our championship show. So we cover across, you know, Premier League predominantly and a bit of England as well. We do European, women's and second tier football, championship football. I'd like to do more. I'd happily do more. There's more areas of football to cover, but I have to find the right combination of presenters and stuff like that. So that's where we are with it at the moment.
But your feeling with that is basically the voice is similar and you're just able to give more room to stories that, you know, are not going to get as much time on the other shows with the Premier League.
There's some crossover.
And all the rest of it.
There's always some crossover.
Yeah,
so we talked about, I mean, earlier today we did a bit on time recording, it's a women's Euro, so we did a bit on England who just beaten Wales pretty handily. So we covered a bit of that on the ramble, but we also throw across to Chloe and Rachel because they're in the weeds of it, doing it, covering it properly. On the Continent came about originally because we were just basically limiting European football to about 10 minutes at the end of an episode a couple times a month or whatever. It just felt like, well, that's a bit token, a bit lip service. We do have access to people who are good and we could make it happen. And On the Continent predates Stack anyway. So, I mean, that was around anyway. Second Tier with Ryan and Justin. I just love those guys. They're great guys. They're really hardworking. They know their stuff. They dedicate themselves to it. It's a really, really tough area to work in because championship football fans are really passionate. They take a lot of stick, but I think they're really good. They always play with a straight bat. And that was an opportunity that I really wanted to pursue. I think that's pretty much it. If there was other areas that we could cover that we'd do well with the same aesthetic, then we would do it. But you know, I always think of like, the studio-based content we make here at Stack is a bit of a spectrum, right? I want it to have one foot in entertainment and one foot in the sport itself. I never want it to deviate too far one way or the other.
Mm.
So I think if it goes too much entertainment, it becomes a bit frivolous and you might as well just be listening to a couple of comedians doing it, which is not for me. And if I go too far that way, it becomes too earnest. And I don't think it serves the listener. I think listeners want to be entertained ultimately. And if you've got a really earnest attitude towards football, like you love tactics or you love transfers and that's it and you think it's the most important thing in the world, you know, good on you, that's good for you, but that's not what we're trying to do here.
Yeah,
so we have to try and find a way to straddle those two things.
Yeah, and you've got to have a strong sense of what it is that you're trying to accomplish as well, I guess, when you're putting stuff out there at this point.
It's got to be reflective of what you're passionate about.
Yeah,
this is not me saying those things are wrong and I'm right. It's about understanding where you sit within the whole ecosystem, I suppose.
Sure. We've mentioned Stack a few times. I mean, so that was 2018, did you say? What prompted the decision to build that out?
Well, we had a few things really. We had a lot of other collective interests. I've never really just been a football person, so I guess there was an itch to scratch there. We wanted to see if the model that we'd developed with the Ramble that had worked quite well could be working in other areas. And we were also just getting opportunities, just meeting people and people coming and saying, like, you know, I've got this idea for a show, do you want to do it? And I was like, oh, I don't really know. I'm not really sure how to do it. But and then it just started to happen and we were like, well, we need a vehicle for this. I also really wanted to run my own business as well. My colleague John, who I run Stack with, who takes care of everything that's not the broadcast bit, He's always kind of wanted us to go into business together and do something. And I was in a position where I kind of, the best managers I had in traditional jobs I had were ones just let me alone.
Yeah.
Just let me get on with it, for better or worse. And I would always clash with anyone who tried to manage me, which is, I think, you know, if I'm being honest, is an arrogant position of mine and is probably a shortcoming of my personality for sure. And I just thought to myself, you know, if you do think you know it all, and you don't want anyone to tell you what to do, which I basically didn't, you probably owe it to yourself and to those around you to actually do it and stop having the best of both worlds and kind of shine away from it. And so that was part of it as well. And then we set about, you know, building the team slowly but surely with what we could afford, reinvesting the money we were making back into the company and building it out. And now it's, you know, we've got 12 full-time people and we make narrative shows and white label shows and studio-based entertainment shows. And they're the kind of three areas that we work in. But it originally came about because we were having ideas, we were getting opportunities and we had no real vehicle for them. And people liked the ramble. People were like, oh, I think I could do that. Can you help me do it?
Yeah.
With what you know. And that's kind of where it started from.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned earlier about, you know, podcasting having or going through this process where people need to take it more seriously and show that it can be a sustainable thing. Was that a part of the inspiration?
Well, obviously at that point you're starting to get into a position where there could be an industry for it. And then you start to do, the way you do it is you structure deals with the people who are making the show and you come to an agreement on the IP and the net revenue and how you share it and split it. And then everyone's got a vested interest in it. So we don't really work in a way where we give people a fee for a show. They're kind of, everyone's dealt in.
Yeah.
Which is how not some of the other independent companies that are rivals of ours work as well, I know. And then if you find an audience and you work really hard at it and you're successful at it, everyone benefits. The problem if you just pay people fees to appear is they're not that kind of invested in it, literally. And also they don't share in the success, right? It's the worst of both worlds, because if it goes to shit, you spent a load of money on on-air talent that's not done anything for you.
Yeah.
You're out of pocket. But if it goes really well, they start to lose interest and drift away because they're not sharing in that success. So that's why we work in that way. And the industry being, you know, present now and you know, turning over money, although there's still a long way to go, makes that possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, obviously, there's a big difference between 2018 and now in that respect. And you were, you know, a fairly early mover in having that sort of stable put together. But what's your point of difference now? Is it that approach basically is how you would say you set yourself apart from some of your competitors in that way?
I think everyone always assumes there needs to be a point of difference. And I think in some cases there does need to be. But I think you also can be successful by being, you know, not necessarily always better than everyone else, but better than other people on certain things and winning enough of the kind of battles that you go into, right? So for example, if there's a show out there that's not performing as it should, and I can reach out to them and say, look, if you come here, I think we can do it better, and here's why. They may or may not say yes. But no one else necessarily even knows that's happening as a conversation. And before anyone knows about it, they're a stack show. I think we've got an authenticity and we've got a track record. I think I see a lot of podcast companies out there. I'm not going to name them, but that don't have hits. And I think, you know, they're funded or they're just, you know, a couple of ex-BBC people or ex kind of whatever. And they get a bit of funding and they think they can do it and they never have a hit. And it does what it does and it disappears. We have got hits. I mean, we've got several hits because we've been good at it. So a point of difference is a track record that actually works.
Yeah.
But I don't think we're doing anything drastically different to anyone else, other than the fact that I think we're probably a lot closer to our respective audiences than a lot of other shows are. But then other shows, you know, they probably don't care. I mean, they're making different types of shows. You know, I'm not suggesting when I kind of criticize or make an observation about another show, it's not for me to say that it's not doing well. It probably is doing well. In fact, I'm sure they are doing well. I mean, you know, but they're doing things slightly differently to us.
Yeah.
And just because you're doing things differently doesn't mean there's an actual point of difference. It just means you're not going to go for the same type of shows, or you're not going to develop the same shows in the same way, or you're not going to produce them in the same way, or you're not going to go after the same on-air talent or whatever. I think it's overplayed how much you need a USP or whatever. I don't think that matters that much, particularly when you've got a combination of, you know, 20 years under your belt doing things quite well. I think it's not a difficult sell for people if they're of the mindset that they want to do it.
Sure. As you mentioned there, you with Stack, you're doing different kinds of podcasts from The Ramble, which is this kind of studio-based conversational show. You've got narrative stuff, you've got documentaries, you've got all sorts of other things. In that context, what makes a great podcast now in 2025? What do you look for? What either as a listener or as, you know, a collaborator, what are you looking at and saying that's something I'm really interested in?
I think there can be loads of different answers to that. I think, you know, I've had company say, I want to make this specific show about this, and I don't care if it only gets 100 listeners, but I want those 100 listeners to be those people.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be really successful on its own terms without hitting a big audience. And then you've got, you know, the Ramble at the other end of the scale. What makes a Ramble a good show is all the things we've talked about. You know, P1, our Formula One show, Matt and Tommy, they're great, like, because they know, almost similar to the Ramble, really. I know Tommy is a big fan of the Ramble. Like, they kind of know what their audience expect. And I can see P1 as a brilliant show without being a big Formula One show fan myself. I just get it. I totally mm-hmm. understand what they're doing and how they do it. And they know their audience so well. So that's part of it. In terms of the narrative stuff, that's obviously totally different again. But the narrative thing is that I want the story to be a truly compelling story that isn't flabby and doesn't go on forever when it doesn't need to, and is maybe teaching people something new, or providing a different angle on something, or revealing something that wasn't known before. But the way you judge a narrative show is totally different to the way you judge an always-on studio show. And I think there's probably as many answers to that question as there are people. I don't think it's for me to tell people what a good podcast is just because I work in this industry. I think that seems like a bit of a kind of syntax error to me. I think clearly if something finds an audience, then they're doing something right. I also quite like stuff that's innovative. I really like that War Game show that came out recently. Have you heard that?
I haven't, no.
Yeah, it's really good. It's just something that's never really, that I can think of, has ever been done before in podcasting, and that was really exciting. It's made by Tortoise and The Observer. Really, really well done. It's like saying what makes a good TV show. I mean, I don't know, what TV shows do you like? I mean, you tell me. I don't feel like I have an authority on that or a position on that that's any better than anyone else's. I mean, there's loads of shows that I think are garbage, but they do really well.
Yeah.
And there's loads of shows that I think have been amazing that don't do anything. We had this show called The Offensive, which is basically like the thick of it for a fictional Premier League team. And it's fucking brilliant. It's so well done. It's still out there to listen to. The guys who made it are really talented. It's really funny. Probably came along 5 years too early. Like, you know, it's got hundreds of episodes.
Yeah.
The people who love it, love it. But it never made a penny.
Yeah.
For us or for them.
Yeah.
And does that make it a bad show? No, it's brilliant. If it came out in 2020 or 2023, it probably would have done millions. Yeah. So there's loads of different factors at play.
Sure. Is there anything out there that you wish you'd done first or wish you'd thought of first, whether that's a show or whether that's a feature that someone else does in their podcast, anything that that jumps out?
I mean, you know, rest is politics, rest is history. They're both pretty good. We thought about what we really wanted to work with Rory Stewart years and years ago. Thought he's quite an interesting guy, but never anywhere. We tried to speak to him when he was running for mayor of London. It didn't happen. I'm not saying we would have made the rest of politics and taken any credit at all for what they've done. That's not what I mean. but yeah, I mean, that War Game show is brilliant. But again, the thing is, this is so, it's hard to answer these without being so nerdy and forensic about it as in my position in the industry.
Yeah.
The reason the War Game is so good is because Tortoise have got so many good contacts and so many good journalists, and they can bring in these people that I'm not that close to because I'm not in that world. And so I think about, would I love to have made it? Well, yeah. Could I have made it? I probably could have made it, but it probably would have been shit.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So like, it's the context is really important. There's loads of shows I've loved over the years, but I do love them as a listener. I'm not always listening to them thinking, oh, we could have made that.
Yeah.
I think the best show that's come out, you know, the best show that came out in 2024 was The English Disease, which we made, and that won the award for best podcast at the Sports Journalism Awards. So, I mean, other people agreed. And that was, I was really proud that the team made that.
Yes, it comes back to knowing what you do and why you do it, I suppose.
Yeah. We're sport leaning, right? Not sport exclusive, but sport leaning. We make studio-based entertainment shows that we've talked about, and I've gone into detail about why that is. We make narrative shows that are really interesting stories to tell because we've got really talented people who can make them really well here, which is crucial because you need to adjust. Sometimes you have to adjust your strategy based on the people you've got, right? And we've got our head of narrative, Nikki. She's amazing, like super talented. One of the most talented people I've ever worked with. Still in her 20s, doing brilliant stuff. She really wanted to make narrative shows. And I was like, well, that'd be great because I want to make them as well. So if you think you can do it, do it. And that's how it started. And then we do like shows for other people, like white label stuff, don't make some stuff for the BBC and all that kind of thing. When the BBC come to us, I look at them and go, I'd love to make shows for the BBC because you get paid money and it's not dependent on advertising because the BBC is massive and the reputation is amazing. And they look at us, and I know this because they've told me, and go, we want that authenticity. We try and make shows like that, like The Ramble. It's not, it doesn't play because people don't think it's the BBC. So they don't think it's as authentic. So can you bring some of that to us? So there's loads of different reasons why you do stuff, but you're right to say that you can't be all things to all people. I mean, I'm not going to go out there and make a show about something I know nothing about. And if some opportunity comes along and no one in the team can do it because we haven't got any knowledge, we're probably not going to make it because I think it would be a bad job. So that comes into play as well.
Yeah. I think you kind of answered this right at the start about whether something like the Football Ramble could come out now or could emerge now, I suppose. Not in the same way, I suppose. But
I think it does come out now in form of like YouTube.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of similarities between young lads making what they think is like honest, authentic observations and funny stuff about football, but they're doing it on YouTube. They're not doing it on a podcast. So the medium is different, but I think the aesthetic is the same.
Yeah.
I think now if you were a young person coming through, you'd probably be a YouTuber rather than a podcaster maybe to start with. But then the whole thing, the barriers between mediums are being broken down anyway. Like, I mean, the biggest discovery platform for us, as far as we're concerned, for podcasting is YouTube now. So that's why we've got to have a video game for all of our shows really now, a video kind of play for all of our shows. And so I think it is happening. I think you look at some of the people out there who've done really well and in loads of cases have done better than we have. They're doing it not in a way I would do it, not with content that appeals to me, but it undeniably works. You know, is it making young people stupider? Probably. But then I'm a 44-year-old man, so I probably would say that, right? The universe should work in that way, right? Old people saying that young people are, you know, making themselves stupider. That's just how it is, right? And people said that about us when we were young. So, look, I think it does happen. I think it's very difficult to imagine it coming in the way that it's came with us in 2007. But then, you know, I've got 18 years of experience about under me now, so we're just very different people. We're older people. We've got families. We do things in a different way. I mean, this is probably a different conversation, but I don't actually think that the terminology and the barriers of what is a TV show and what is a YouTube show and what is a podcast and what is a radio show is actually that important anymore because, you know, Talk Sport's focus is, of course, their linear radio channels, but they're all over YouTube, 24 hours a day, it seems like. They're doing exclusive stuff on their YouTube. They're putting podcasts out. What's the overlap with Gary Neville, where it's a YouTube show that's also a podcast with a TV budget with TV stars, right? No one cares. Like, I wonder if we'll even be using the word podcast in a few years' time. We'll just be making shows.
Yeah.
And sooner or later, I'll tell you what's going to happen. Sooner or later, Netflix or Prime or someone will start taking podcasts and doing them in a really big way.
I mean, at the very, very top end of the market, obviously, but there's already, you know, conversations about Netflix.
But that'll become more egalitarian. I think essentially what you're going to be doing is you're going to be seeing like media owners fighting for, as ever, for eyeballs and for ears, but they're just going to be doing it in the broadest way possible. So it's quite easy to imagine like there not being that much difference between, you know, you're watching an episode of The Traitors on the same platform you're watching a movie, on the same platform you are listening to a show that's also, you know, visualized, and no one's going to care about it. And it's probably already happening, but we just don't have the words for it yet because we're still stuck on these kind of, that's a TV show, that's a movie, that's a podcast. And I think actually with streaming and stuff like that, you know, people still talk about it as TV, but I don't know how, I mean, you know better than me, what percentage of stuff on Netflix is watched on a TV? It's probably like a really small amount of people. It's just a show, isn't it?
I mean, you guys are moving studios as well.
Yeah, we're moving studios because our studio-based shows need to be more visually interesting. This studio we're sitting in now was built before visuals became important. So what we did is we prioritised sound. We do have visuals in here, if people would have seen, but we don't have a visual-first studio.
Yeah.
And there's other reasons as well. We wanted to kind of change it up for different reasons, but we want to become more visually interesting. And I guess that's part of it as well.
Well, there we go.
Yeah.
Three questions that I've been asking everyone before we wrap up.
Okay.
Have you got an origin story when it comes to sport, something that kind of kindled your interest in it?
Not really. I think I've always grown up liking sport. I went to my first game at Fratton Park as a Portsmouth fan when I was 11. Played football since like under eights or whatever. I think I really got into the kind of culture around it when I got a Saturday job at a sports shop.
Okay.
And there was a football team attached to that sports shop. And then they became my close friends. And so we would do Saturdays in the shop, Sundays we'd play football, and during the week we'd go and watch games together and kind of got into the culture around it in our own way. And I think that was interesting to me because it was like older guys
right.
who like really loved sport. And then none of them actually worked in sport, but it kind of gave me the idea that that's what I was really passionate about. Is that music really? And I did a bit of music as a job, but I kind of came out of that and started doing this. So I think it's always been a part of my life. It's almost a bit like, have you got an origin story about music? It's always around, right?
Yeah.
My parents, my family liked music. It was kind of part of our upbringing, part of our kind of overall milieu of life, really.
Yeah, but I think the thing about you being able to identify when you became the kind of fan you are now, I suppose, is interesting.
Well, I've always had quite a Catholic set of interests. I did a master's in like American history and politics, right? A few years ago. I just was just interested in it. I think the biggest blessing I've ever been given is that I'm passionately and authentically interested in lots of things.
Yeah.
Like, and I've not trained myself to do that. I'm not saying I'm knowledgeable about them, I'm good at them or whatever. I am just always interested. Like if I chat to someone, I'm almost like embarrassingly interested in what they're doing. Like, I mean, the other day we had the guy repointing our house, right? And I was out there for about half an hour asking him about it, right? And he was like, "Can I get on with it?" You know, I'm just interested in lots of different stuff.
Yeah.
And sport's part of that, and I think that's been a real blessing for me because I think if you're interested in stuff, you're never really bored. You never really kind of struggle for a purpose to do something. And so for me, that's been the biggest blessing, and sport has probably been, along with music, right at the very top of that.
Yeah. New from Stack, repointing.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'll find an audience. Like most of our shows.
What is your favourite piece of sports storytelling?
That's a good question. I'd say my favourite piece of sports storytelling is probably a book called This Bloody Mary Is the Last Thing I Own by Jonathan Rendell. Who is sadly no longer with us, but a amazing, amazing writer. And This Bloody Mary is a story of him exploring the world of boxing through being a promoter, but also traveling out to Vegas and following people around and going to find old, obscure boxers that he loved and finding out what they're up to now. Beautifully written, amazingly put together story and narrative. And it deserves to have been read by a lot more people because every time I mention it, no one seems to know it.
Mm.
But if you like boxing, which is probably my second favourite sport, it's an absolute must read. That would be my favourite.
Okay, I'll be sure to check that out.
And anything by George Plimpton as well, who's the great American sports writer.
Yeah. He also found a lot of kind of richness in boxing stories as well.
He did.
Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah.
I mean, maybe this is a hint into the last question. Is there a sports story you want to tell or see somebody else tell?
Yeah, there's a story. There's a journalist called Sean Williams, who I know a little bit. Brilliant journalist. He's based in New Zealand now. He goes all over the world telling stories and does these kind of really rich, deep dive, long read stories. There's probably only a handful of the people out there in the world now do that kind of journalism, sadly, because there's just not a market for it now. But he does it. And he wrote a story for a website called Outside. About a guy called Kurt Steiner, who's the world record stone skimming champion.
Right.
And he lives this kind of Spartan hermit existence in, like, I think it's in like Missouri or something like that, where he just dedicates his whole life to skimming
stones.
Someone
with a big lake.
Yeah, basically, yeah. And Sean wrote that story, kind of immersed himself with Kurt Steiner. And it's such a rich, amazing read. And I really, really wanted to make it as a narrative show for Stack, but I couldn't get the production team to come along with me, so it didn't happen. But he's just a really interesting guy, Kurt, and that story's brilliant. I reckon anyone listening to this who's interested in this kind of thing should seek it out. That is a story that needs to be told. That needs to be a kind of deep as breath type, free solo type you know, doc that would do really well. But for now, the story, as it's written, is a really, really good read. And that's something that I think more people should read.
All right. I love that.
Yeah, okay. It's great.
Well, I will be sure to read that.
Thank you.
And
on behalf of Sean Williams, I'll pass it on.
And Luke, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks, Rob.
Outlines is an original production from 2640.